Everyone's experience is unique to them. This podcast contains the personal story, experience, and opinions of the speaker, rather than that of Breast Cancer Now. Hello and welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. This is a series that shares the stories of people who have had breast cancer. It's also where you'll hear the voices of our nurses, researchers, and experts who help to provide support for today and hope for the future to anyone affected by breast cancer. Hello and welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. My name is Em and today I'll be speaking with Fiona. At the time she was diagnosed with breast cancer, Fiona was already undergoing treatment for her mental health. We'll be speaking about how comorbidities can affect breast cancer treatment and the importance of considering both mental and physical health after a diagnosis. Fiona, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me. It's nice to be with you, Em.
So Fiona, normally with our podcast, we would start by talking about a breast cancer diagnosis, but I think in this case, it might make a bit more sense to just talk about what your health was already like before that. So would you mind sharing just a little bit about your experience with mental illness and how it's affected you?
So I think at the time I was diagnosed in March 2020. Mm. And at the time I had been struggling with depression and anxiety, but it had been further complicated by a post-traumatic stress response. And so I'd been struggling for quite a while and I'd been receiving private counselling and had been on the waiting list for EMDR through the NHS, which is a trauma treatment. Interestingly enough, at the time I was diagnosed physically, I'd been very run down physically, and I think we all people that have suffered with depression recognize that it kind of comes with that level of fatigue and yeah. low motivation, just everything's difficult. And physically, at the point I was diagnosed, I remember thinking, oh my God, this is the best I've felt in years. And you're going to inject me with poison. And yeah, so there was a lot of kind of, I'm feeling bad, I'm feeling good, there's this. It destabilized an awful lot, actually.
I can totally imagine how kind of disorienting that must have been to kind of feel that your health was going on the up in one way and then just to be told in a whole other capacity that actually now you've got this to deal with. So at the time you were diagnosed with breast cancer, you say you were receiving, what was the name of the therapy?
So it's EMDR, which stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's a very technical treatment. It's one of the two treatments that I think are recommended for trauma on the NHS. So I went in and said, oh, actually, I've found a lump and they're sending me for scans. So I'd literally just started the treatment and I think the waiting had been 16 months at that point.
Oh, God, yeah.
It wasn't just a diagnosis of breast cancer, because obviously in March 2020, mm-hmm. this thing called lockdown happened.
That old thing.
Yeah. It just so much happened at the same time. And it did. It had a profound impact. Although I feel things had been on an upward trajectory, when I got the diagnosis, I do remember my mental health took a dip, a real, real dip. And I was having sort of some suicidal ideation and just thoughts of like, oh, maybe this would be the easy way out. Maybe I don't have treatment. And that might sound awful to people who are like, oh my God. And it's not something that I was actively or genuinely considering. It was just, there was such a sense of, I've been fighting for years at that point. I'd been struggling for 4 years and I was just like, I'm done. I'm done. I'm too tired. I cannot do this. So very, very briefly, there was that thought of just, I give up.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that, actually, because I think sometimes people will feel those sort of dark thoughts, if we can sort of frame it in a palatable way, I guess. And they might feel that. And, you know, when they're asked about it by mental health professionals, if they say, you know, have you had any suicidal ideation, people might think, well, no, I have no intent. But that's still a very horrible thing to have to bear.
I absolutely. And I think there's a lot of fear and a lot of shame and a lot of prejudice and misunderstanding. And it's like, you know, no one, as you say, no one wants to have these thoughts. And I think there has been this especially in media, it's kind of like, oh, it was just a cry for help. Since when has a cry for help been just a cry for help? You know, if someone's calling for help, it's like, you know what, shit, there's stuff going on here. But I also think that there's now more, generally speaking, recognition that suicidal ideation, or although there is usually, broadly speaking, no intent, it is a marker of significant distress. And that's important. And I do think, I did speak to my breast cancer nurse. I was aware enough. I was like, yeah, do you know what? A couple of weeks ago, you weren't feeling like this. Talk about it. And I think I probably did it before it got so deep that I was feeling unable to actually reach out of that and be able to talk to someone, because that's something that does happen. You just go, nobody wants to know. Nobody wants to, I couldn't possibly tell anybody. Yeah. So I'm glad I took that step at the time that I did. And to be fair, my breast cancer nurse was absolutely amazing. And she was like, I'm so glad you told me. And she did the safety stuff. Will you tell me if, you know, you have more thoughts, you do begin to plan. And so I felt very safe and I felt very heard. And that is something to be grateful for, because I know not everybody has that experience.
And yeah, as you've just mentioned there, your breast care nurse was there to look out for you in terms of your mental health as well as your physical health. But when you actually started treatment for breast cancer, I understand you then had to stop the EMDR therapy.
Yes, I did have to stop the EMDR. They were looking at how the service could cope through the pandemic, and they were looking at different changes. But even if something had been available at that time, EMDR is quite a profound treatment. It can leave you feeling a little bit emotionally, well, not a little bit, it can leave you feeling very emotionally vulnerable. And it can be quite tiring. And to do that alongside chemotherapy would just be cruel and unusual. But what I found gobsmacking and just really gold standard, actually, in my view, was my psychologist said, you know, I'll keep you on the books. And even though you're not having the actual the rapid movement, eye movement treatment, I will check in. And she phoned or she texted every single week. And if I wasn't able to, she was just like, if you're tired with chemo, just a two-word. And there was times, I remember once I says, you know, I do need a phone call. And so she phoned me up when she was able to, and she says, what's wrong? And I think it was fairly early on in the chemo journey, and I was sore and uncomfortable, and I literally couldn't find a comfortable place on my bed. And I just spoke to her and I said, you know, I want to have a temper tantrum. I want to literally drum my hands and feet. I mean, my partner was incredibly supportive, but I think there is that when your emotions are so involved, your boundaries do get a little bit blurred, and then you start to caretake your partner and they start to caretake you. And it's like, you know, I need someone who's a little bit just rant, and I'm not going to freak out about it. I'm just going to be here and then it can just be over. And so I felt incredibly supported and gobsmacked that she was just so willing and able to be there. And I've asked her subsequently, I'm like, why did she do that? And she was like, well, why wouldn't I? And I was going, yeah, okay, I don't have an answer to that. I just know that it's not usual. And I look back at it now, chemotherapy was not easy for me at all. And I would not want to go through it again without that support in order to be able to compare and contrast. But my sense is that having that support made a significant impact to how I came through it and how I've been mentally post-treatment. And so I remain incredibly grateful. Without knowing the precise impact it had, I believe it had a huge impact.
Yeah. Absolutely. And like you say, it's quite perhaps uncharacteristic for a psychologist, for a mental health professional to actually, you know, stay in touch. For any health professional, I guess, to sort of stay in touch when you're not in active treatment and you already had such a long wait time before.
Absolutely. And I think the NHS is, as we know, is crumbling. And I don't have any answers on that one. I'm just profoundly grateful that this particular professional viewed her duty in that way and was able to follow through.
Yeah. Don't worry, we're not expecting you to have answers. We're not expecting you to fix the entire system. I think the important thing is having these conversations, right? And making it known to people that can fix things that this is happening. Because I mean, obviously you had pre-existing mental health concerns, and then breast cancer, I imagine, had a whole separate impact on that. Have you since sort of had to pursue mental health treatment that takes that into consideration? Have you been able to find that?
I have, again, been extremely blessed and very fortunate. I had private therapy that I was able to continue through my treatment. That long-term support, and there was sometimes I didn't speak to my therapist for maybe 4 weeks because it was like, no, that chemo cycle was really bad. I'm tired. There's nothing particularly active, but I kind of had that two-pronged support. Since my active treatment ended in September, October 2020, I have noticed it's been really, I think everybody talks about how treatment ends and you feel like you're cut off from, you know, you've got all the regular hospital appointments. And so it's spoken to you and you sort of theoretically know that it's a thing.
Hmm.
But then when it happens, you're like, oh, it's a thing. And then you're actually feeling this thing that people have talked about. And you're like, oh, my God, this is weird. Why am I feeling this way? I finished my treatment. I should, all these shoulds. I should be feeling this. I should be doing that. And I think one thing in particular that had a massive impact on my mental health was I finished chemotherapy. I had 2 weeks of radiotherapy and then I started hormone treatment. Oh my God. And that hit me like a ton of bricks because you kind of finish the acute journey and then it's like, oh, sorry, but you're not actually going to feel that great because now the chronic long-term part of the journey and you're like, oh. And I really, really wasn't prepared for how my hands and fingers stopped working. They're much better now. They've adapted. I take supplements and I you know, do different things to look after myself. But just initially, I remember waking up one night and going, I can't actually clench my fists.
Mm.
And that was terrifying. And right at that point, I think my resilience and ability to deal with the pain, I mean, the pain I had from the hormone treatment wasn't crippling, but my tolerance for it, my resilience to it was extremely low. And so at that point, I was contacting my breast cancer nurse. I have made use of Breast Cancer Now services. The nurse helpline, a couple of times I phoned the nurse helpline, just sometimes I was so flat. And it was just amazing to have someone on the other end who listened without judgment, could give a little bit of medical knowledge if it was required, but pretty much just went, do you know what? It sounds like you're dealing with a hell of a lot there and you're doing really well. And the other aspect of it's not counseling, it's not mental health support, but the Someone Like Me service, I was matched with someone who had also had counseling, and just being able to share that sort of understanding and aspect of sometimes it doesn't need to make sense. Sometimes you are just scared, tired, angry, deeply upset, distressed, any of these emotions, and someone who just got it. And that was priceless, absolutely priceless.
And I think I'm right in saying that you now work for the Someone Like Me service as well. You volunteer for them now.
I do. I think I made that decision really, really early while I was receiving support because I was just aware of, oh my, I'm not saying she saved my life, but I will say, I think she saved my sanity. I think there was a couple of points I was like, ah, and it made such a difference. that very, very early on, I knew that I wanted to be part of that, to give that back, and to be that voice on the end of the phone saying to someone, do you know what, I get it. And it does suck. And you are perfectly entitled to do, you know, throw the toys out the pram and feel as shitty as you like, and to scream and shout and swear and cry and giggle. You know, it's you ride the roller coaster of emotions, and it does make you feel sometimes I'm losing the plot here, because I was in tears like half an hour ago, and now I'm, you know, chuckling and giggling over something really ridiculous. And that in itself can be quite fatiguing, riding that roller coaster of, it's not hysteria, but it's just your emotions are all over the place. They really are. And yeah, having the comfort of someone saying, yeah, it's like that, it happens, it's okay, is beyond words.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose at this point, I should just clarify for anyone who's listening and who's unaware, the Someone Like Me service is what it sounds like, pretty much. So you got matched with someone who had a similar diagnosis to you, similar breast cancer experience to you, and you were able to just talk it out with someone who understands.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. And were there any other kind of any other resources of that kind of community support that you found helpful?
It's not specifically breast cancer and not professional mental health, but I suppose I would say it's peer support. It's a Facebook group belonging to this. It's a journal that's published by a couple of guys who just got together and were going through a difficult time, and they came up with something called The Way of the Tortoise. It is exactly what it sounds like. It is based on the hare and the tortoise, and basically that you are not going to get anywhere in life manically running about, comparing your journey to anybody else's, or trying to go at a pace that is anything other than right for you. I mean, that's really oversimplified. And I was going through the journal and filling it in as I could. And, you know, it's supposed to take 4 months to fill a book. And I think I filled my first book and it took me just under a year because I was doing it during the cancer treatment. And I think it helped me have acceptance towards myself. And so sometimes I posted on the Facebook group, and the love and support, and actually there was an awful lot of people there who were breast cancer and other cancer survivors who were able to kind of just offer some love and support and say, you're doing really well, or thank you for sharing that. The best advice I was given was to join breast cancer groups, but be discerning. Because if you're vulnerable, if you're feeling at low ebb and you go on for support and you start reading lots of posts from other people needing support, you can get pulled down. So there is something about managing your own boundaries within that. But I did find a space there where people were accepting and understanding. And that's also where I became aware of people who had comorbidities, who had other mental health problems, and who had been dumped by their NHS mental health support services, who could not find somebody who understood what they needed, and who were literally in that moment like they were at the end of their rope and the end of the tether. And I think that's what really made me aware of the huge chasm between what I'd experienced and maybe what the general experience was, and made me realize that, you know, you're if you have a mental illness or you have a mental health difficulty, it doesn't stop because you have a breast cancer diagnosis. If you have an autoimmune condition, it doesn't stop when you get a breast, you know. And I think sometimes services are maybe so stretched that it's like, well, we'll focus on this. And it's like, yeah, but the patient doesn't have the option of going, well, I won't have mental health problems while I deal with my cancer. It doesn't work like that. The two coexist. They interact, they overlap, and sometimes they make both things much, much worse. We are a holistic, integrated individual, and I think it's really important to recognize that these acute diagnoses don't happen disconnected from other processes that may be going on.
Absolutely. I think you said that all so well. And while you're telling your story, while you're kind of mentioning other people's experiences that you've been made aware of, a lot of what is apparent in that is you were sort of an exception to the rule in that you were able to continue having some mental health support.
Yeah.
And that a lot of the support that is out there tends to be charity-led, community-led.
Yes.
It's not something that people might know to seek out until they're really in the weeds and they become aware that actually they are depressed and they do need support.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think from that point of view, it's really important to have these conversations so that people, there's been conversations had in various places that, you know, nothing seems to be out there on the internet addressing breast cancer and mental health. It's too easy to feel, I think, that you are alone and that you're, you know, I don't want to make a fuss and, you know, they're really busy. And I'm not discounting that. The NHS is really busy and is really stressed, but that is not the patient's responsibility. The patient's responsibility is to actually ask for, and it is so hard to be our own advocate. I know that. And somehow we have to own that and go, actually, I am going to ask for what I need. Mm. And go, okay, phoning back tomorrow doesn't really cut it. I feel I need something. And I think there is a genuine role for peer support, which is becoming much more widely recognised in communities like the breast cancer community, in the mental health community. I think people are recognising that peer support is a fantastic resource if it's managed and
some kind of structured, regulated.
Do you know what I mean? Not official, but just maybe with a little bit of structure so that there are processes in place to manage if things potentially get a little bit fraught. There is huge potential there. And ultimately, that's what the Someone Like Me service is. It's peer support. And I think it's fantastic to have that peer support for breast cancer. I'm having ideas now. I'm like, could we have a Someone Like Me breast cancer and mental health peer support service? I don't know. I'll put it out there. But I know we have lots of volunteers who, like myself, have experience and who are willing to talk about it and who have said, you know what, I've been there. I've had those dark thoughts. I'm not actually scared to be on the phone with someone who's maybe feeling that way. And because I felt so alone, I would want to be on the other end of the phone rather than kind of go, oh, I'm not sure I could deal with that, because it's a devastating place to be and it's a very lonely place to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I mean, you touched on it just now with your kind of, oh, maybe we can do this. in kind of an ideal world, What sort of services would you like to see for people with pre-existing conditions, whether that's mental or physical, who then have a diagnosis of breast cancer? That is a huge question. I understand that. But sort of how would your experience have perhaps been a little smoother, if nothing else, if you were able to sort of have your mental health considered as well as what that acute diagnosis that you then got?
It is a huge question.
It's okay not to like, it's okay, we can not answer this question, we can say we don't know.
I'm what I will say is I don't know whether the answer is a service so much or whether it's like having more people like my psychologist who get that actually maybe there's a third option between continuing a treatment or discontinuing a treatment. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, they've been on the waiting list. This diagnosis has happened, which isn't their fault, or this condition, and maybe there's a way. You know, we have this, we talk about, you know, individualized care and person-centered and all the rest of it. And it's lovely. I personally don't think it happens nearly anywhere as much as we think it does, and the reason it doesn't is because it's bloody difficult. It is very, very difficult to provide individualized service to literally thousands of people. But I think if we can encourage individual practitioners to just, you know what, this is Fiona has had 4 years of struggling to get better. And she's been feeling great and now is facing something which is designed to save her life, but is going to make her feel like shit. And potentially, actually, she won't ever get back to feeling the way she does right now. So there's lots of grief involved in that. There's lots of anger involved in that. And now she's got breast cancer. We know that that causes fear, uncertainty, changes in self conception, lots of different things. Just can we educate ourselves actually about how these things do impact, and be more willing to listen to the person and kind of go, because I could have been told, well, it's, you know, we will do this to you. You know, we will keep in touch, or we won't keep in touch. But actually what happened was my psychologist worked with me and it was collaborative. Hmm. What support will help you if you want a call? And so it was very mutual. And I would like to see us move towards a way where the patient is the educator. Because I hear people say, oh, well, the doctors know best. The doctors know the science. Hmm. I am the expert in what it feels like to live in my body. I am the expert of knowing, actually, you're telling me, for example, I had white blood cell boosting injections. And at one point I phoned up and I was like, I cannot take these anymore. I'm in so much pain. I want to die. And I was told, well, basically you have to. And I'm like, I'm not gonna, because I literally cannot, because I know in my body, you don't know what the pain is like. I do. I do not have another injection in me. Fortunately, I spoke to somebody else and I discovered you can get one-off injection, which is still painful, but it is much gentler than having the daily seven. And that's what I moved on to. And this is what I mean by being your own advocate. Mm. Yeah, I know I need to take them for my own safety. I'm telling you, I'm at my limit. We need to understand that the doctors are the experts, but we're also our own experts. Can we find a way of getting those two things to link in, to meet? That would be my answer to that question.
And I mean, it was a huge question, and I feel like you've made some excellent points there. We actually, in a previous episode, spoke to Liz O'Riordan, who was a breast cancer surgeon, and who was later diagnosed with breast cancer. Mm. And it was only once she saw the other side of that, that she, you know, despite having worked with it for so long, you don't really know it until you know it.
You absolutely don't at all. And I think maybe acknowledging that is maybe the first part of opening the door to being able to hear what's coming from the other side, is recognizing, actually, I haven't been there, so I don't know. So what this person is telling me might sound like science fiction, but actually they are on that other side, so they do know. Mm. Maybe there's something about acknowledging that is the first point of breaking down that boundary between professional and patient. Subjective experience definitely changes it. Without a doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. We have breast cancer now. We have our breast cancer voices. I believe you're actually part of that, perhaps.
I am, and I've signed up to be a louder voice. You know, I have lots to say, and I want to shout about it.
Yeah, brilliant. And that's exactly what that network is for. Is for you've got the experience. You know it from your side of the treatment, and with that experience is invaluable to doctors, to breast care nurses, to anyone who is involved in that process. And the more we just have these conversations, the more it's involved in that education stage, the more it will hopefully carry through to future patient experience.
Absolutely.
I think we've covered so much there in quite a short space of time. Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
That's an even bigger question than the last one. I've taken part in research that's been undertaken by various universities. And there was something about the role of acceptance and sort of more mindful, meditative kind of things, the role of that in managing, I think it was pain and side effects and hormone treatment. All I will say about that is that it sometimes is spoken about very, very glibly. But I have found that to be helpful, but I apply it in a way that works for me. Yeah. And I would say to anyone who is struggling and who's maybe read some stuff on mindfulness or ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy. There's lots of different things out there. And it's kind of gone, oh, it's not for me. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Maybe that particular approach didn't work. I know a lot of people find focusing on the breath, particularly if they have respiratory disorders, it's really not helpful for them. Mm. Doesn't have to be that. Yeah, you can rub your hands together and just focus on the feeling of friction between your hands. There's lots of different things that you can do to ground yourself and bring yourself into the moment and just create that a little bit of space from the maelstrom of thoughts and feelings. Sometimes I think we can kind of think that is who we are. Mm. But actually, if I stop, I can recognize that I'm paying attention to my hands rubbing, or I'm paying attention to my breath, or I'm paying attention to the cold feet if I'm having a paddle in the ocean, that I'm actually observing these experiences, and it's not me that's having these feelings and emotions. That's an experience I'm having, but it's not who I am. Mm. I think it's worthwhile exploring and keep trying until you find something that works for you, because very often people will go, oh, I did, for example, this journal, that worked great for me. It's not going to work for everybody. Talk to as many people as possible, research, find different ways of being. I love mindful coloring. I have like literally thousands of those books. I need to move into a separate house for them. That works for me. Mm. Find something that, if possible, takes you a little bit out of yourself and just gives you a little bit of breathing space. It has had a huge impact on my mental health, and I have had to struggle and find the fit that worked for me, because it's like, that, no, I'm not going to do that. That doesn't work. No, that feels stressful. No, I don't like that. It's trial and error. Mm. And it took quite a while, but I feel like I've got the tools that work for me. Mm. And that's important.
So important. And I'm really glad that you have those tools. I know it must have taken a long time to work out what worked for you, but you have those now, and I'm so happy to hear that.
I am too. And part of it was asking what hasn't worked. Because yeah. if you can identify what's irritated you about something, it prevents you from going down a lot of blind alleys. I speak from experience.
No, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for sharing all this, for sharing. You mentioned so many helpful resources in that. And I think just, yeah, doing exactly, practicing what you preach here in actually talking about these things and educating through having these conversations is just massively important. So thank you so, so much, Fiona.
I'm unbelievably pleased and very privileged to have been here. And it's been lovely, really lovely talking to you, Em. Thank you so much.
If you've enjoyed listening to this episode of the Breast Cancer Now podcast, make sure to subscribe via your preferred podcast provider so that you never miss an episode. Also, if you're able to, we'd love it if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and perhaps recommend us to someone you think would find us helpful. The more people we can reach, the more we can get Breast Cancer Now's vital resources to those who need them.